motherfucker's gonna have the news.
It's Monday, September 2nd, 2019.
Labor Day.
LA Podcast. Happy Labor Day.
That's your Labor Day voice?
I'm reminded, yes, that's my voice celebrating the working people of the United States. I'm reminded every holiday that we should not have chosen Monday as our release date, because
there are a ton of holidays.
There, most holidays are on Mondays.
Yeah,
it turns out. And every year,
we just keep going.
Yeah,
whatever.
Well, what day would you have it if it wasn't Monday?
Tuesday.
there are a
Wednesday
couple of other choices.
But the week is our the news Thursday? Has already started happening.
But it all happens on Monday too. Where like it's either Monday is a holiday or the day that all the news happens.
Right. Yeah. Well, what we run up against is that Hayes literally has a podcast every other day of the week. So
Friday's open. Friday's still open. We have an interview this week that is great with Maya Lau. I don't know if it's great. I wasn't
it
there.
Is great.
It is great.
It is great.
Maya is great.
We have our most referenced personage of all time returning to talk about the Sheriff's Department.
First repeat guest?
First repeat guest. We get into a lot of big stories with the Sheriff's Department with her. And of course, we cannot get into anywhere close to all of them. So we had to kind of pick and choose. Also, Alyssa's daughter, Avery, was in attendance. And if you hear someone chewing on, what are they? Veggie puffs?
Yeah. They have these things that are puffs. Aren't they just Cheetos? Like they have these things for kids that are like these veggie.
I don't know if anybody would know. It would probably be you.
I just can't believe it. We're all just feeding our kids Cheetos. But yeah, if you hear like some like, it's not me. It's not me like chewing on the microphone.
Or imagine it's
Alex Villanueva's place. Cutting a hole in the door. Stories from this week. I have a little one from a week ago. I went to a neighborhood council meeting in Central Hollywood and heard a lot of interesting complaints that people have in that area. There was one guy talking about how people are not respecting the sign on his wall that requests quiet.
Uh-huh.
And he was wondering what the legal recourse he could have for people talking outside his house. Central Hollywood. And I was thinking, how did you end up
here
in this place
of all places?
You have to move. The center of Hollywood.
Does no one respect signs put up by private individuals anymore?
But anyway, one of the neighborhood council members is a guy named Louis Abramson, who I had seen at CELA events before and knew a little bit from Twitter. And he was talking at one point about 4118, the new proposed restrictions on where people who are homeless can sleep or sit or lie down. And he brought up Article 34, which is in the California Constitution. We've talked about it in the past, that basically says that cities can't build public housing or even affordable housing without putting it on the ballot. Each project has to go on the ballot. It's a racist law that was passed decades ago and that we're still paying the price for. But then he mentioned that there was another ballot measure that passed in the 2000s that allows LA specifically to build 3,500 public housing units per district.
Right.
And I heard that and I was like, oh, this poor guy, he is completely misinformed. If that existed, I would definitely know about it. So it must not be true. And then I Googled it after. It is true.
Yep.
I texted it to you two. I don't want to blow up your spot, but neither you didn't know about it either. None of us were aware that this existed.
Yeah. After we had this conversation, I realized somebody had brought that up on Twitter after one of the last times we talked about Article 34. And I kind of did that. It just kind of went right by me too. But yeah, basically was unaware of the buildable limit that we already have baked in. And so has anybody reached that number as far as like individual council districts?
Maybe 14, possibly 9 areas around downtown. But this article, I went back to and found an LA Times article from February of this year talking about it that said LA can build 3,500 public housing units per council district, but with the HHH campaign to build 10,000 units of homeless housing, some neighborhoods are close to the cap, it says.
Right.
Not that many.
Yeah.
Not in CD12.
Not in CD12, which we'll talk about very soon. But that's my LA story for this week. That was just an absolutely mind-blowing thing I learned, that LA is well within its Article 34 rights to build tens of thousands of units of straight up public housing. I did not think that that was something that they were allowed to do.
And this is what, like, it gets back to what we have talked about a number of times in the past, where our housing crisis, our local leaders have continually deferred blame to Sacramento, even when they do have a license to act.
Yep.
Unconscionable. I was talking to
use that sound bite. That's for our like morning zoo soundboard.
Unconscionable.
You muttering unconscionable.
So Hayes was kind enough to bring me over here with the recording equipment today, and I was regaling him with my very pathetic LA story, which is that now that I've returned from my honeymoon in France, LA has kind of given me the side eye and is kind of like, oh, you thought you were too good for us, huh?
And maybe go back.
Really loading up a couple punches on me. I came home, I found out my oven won't light once I got back home. I just today tried starting the car that my wife and I share, and the car wouldn't start. So I had to like do, I guess, the very LA thing where I'm trying to learn everything I can about car maintenance within the span of 15 minutes while I panic about not being able to make a prior appointment. And I found out that my neighbor had canceled my Wi-Fi account, which is not something that I was aware could happen. So basically, I've more or less been evicted from the city in the 10 days that I was away. Now I've come home and I'm leading a sort of itinerant lifestyle where
it's post-fossil fuel and Wi-Fi future.
Back to the earth.
I'm fully off the grid. I'm stopping in to just let you guys know that
nature is reclaiming Scott.
Yeah, you look different.
I feel grizzled, I would say, yes. That's me. I don't know where I go from here.
Is it heat related, you think? It's hot.
Like karmic heat, you mean?
Wi-Fi, for sure.
Well, like your car not working and maybe something melted in your oven. I guess the oven should be equipped to withstand.
You don't need the oven. It's so hot. Yeah. You're fine.
I wanted to just roast some vegetables for the week. I looked up on Google like reasons why my car wouldn't start, and I got a couple of answers that I then took to Jiffy Lube, and the guy kind of looked at me like I was out of my mind. So I think I'm back at square one.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Oh, you saved us a lot of time, sir. But
yeah,
Alyssa, what's your story?
I'm just gonna do an update on our splash pad count for since it's gonna be hot. I published a map at Curbed of LA's best splash pads. I know this is the content that you have been waiting for.
I think this is really cool.
It's hard hitting. splash pads are the future because we need more of them because it's going to be hot, but they're also really good for parents and for people of differing abilities because you can get in them and get wet and cool down. You could be a person who doesn't have access to an air conditioner, or maybe doesn't have access to a place to live. And it is this nice equal space for all people to tough out these days. You can even go at night to some of these splash pads, like in Grand Park. And then we have a new splash pad that just opened at the Music Center Plaza that underwent a $40 million renovation. They're doing a lot of events there. I don't know if you've ever been there. If you haven't been to, I know you guys both have like season tickets to the opera probably, and you're there all the time. But if you aren't there for performance, you wouldn't have probably gone up there because it was just this like old fountain with the sculpture that's like famous, but then they moved it out of the way now because it's more about the space. So
I go there on my way to the Ferraro building.
Oh yes,
I'll pass
when you're
to
yeah
get to the Ferraro
well now
building.
There's actually I ran there from my house, and then I run around the DWP building because it's such like a cool thing. Yeah. You just run in a circle in a lake basically. And then you come across the street, although they need better pedestrian crossings there. You come across the street and then you have this gorgeous plaza, and then you can run all the way down to City Hall and protest what is going on in there, and then, you know, come back up, and it's just this wonderful like rolling park that just keeps going and going and going. So
and cool off it's and running an, through
yeah,
the
cool
splash
off
pads.
Yeah, just go from splash. There's like two splash pads within a block of each other. You can see one splash pad from another splash pad, which is kind of unfair for the rest
that's
of the city.
Living, but, honestly. Yeah.
But the best part about the new Music Center Plaza is they have a coffee shop. Well, they also have a coffee shop. There's a Starbucks next to the Grand Park one, but they have a Go Get 'em Tiger, and then they have a wine bar next to it. So you can splash
with a splash.
A splash of old bubbly. Yeah.
We need to pull out the parking on Sunset and have splash pad lanes going from
wow, this is
East
like beyond
Hollywood
what I've
downtown.
Even dedicated splash pad.
Dedicated splash permanent pad
slip and slide.
Yeah. Oh, that slip and slide would be perfect.
What is going on this week? John Lee, newest council member, not waiting to get to work, is starting right away,
yeah,
canceling homeless housing projects in his district. The Daily News reported earlier this week, I think on the 26th, hey, good news, the Northwest Valley, CD12, could actually get its first homeless housing project. It was on these proposed sites for HHH. So they call them the Topanga Apartments. It's on Topanga Canyon Boulevard. It was replacing a used car lot and like a little garage. It seemed like a great idea. John Lee comes along, I think 3 days later, and says, absolutely not happening. Mm-hmm. He says he's not going to throw his support behind it. But what that means for all intents and purposes is that it just will not happen. They can't cancel projects on their own anymore, but they can slow walk them to the point where it's just not worth doing. So it looks like now they have to start from scratch, find a new site. He says that the project was dropped on the community unfairly, basically, even though they had just proposed the site and then it was going to go through those conversations, but now they'll have to go through them somewhere else. I mean, this is kind of what I was speculating after the election. The fact that he is now in campaign mode again says to me that he is not going to let, whether it's Board of Housing or bus lanes or anything like that, none of it is happening in CD12 until November.
March. Oh, you mean next November?
Yeah, I mean next November. Okay. I mean, this is like, look, unless he wins outright in March.
But or loses outright.
Yes.
He's more popular, John Lee is, among sitting LA City Council members than he is among arguably the voters in his district. He won by 1,000 votes. It wasn't certainly a mandate to go full tilt and start ripping out bus lanes that are being planned to be built or canceling homeless housing. It was a by the skin of his teeth victory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're totally right. He's going to use it as a mandate to be as bullish as he can until the next round of elections, because this was, of course, a special election, is completed. I don't know that that will necessarily help him when March comes around and you have the overwhelmingly more progressive and more engaged Democratic primary electorate, as opposed to a random special election in August. Mm-hmm. I think being the candidate that is very much out front of canceling homeless housing, canceling transit lanes, is going to be bad for him. And I think it's also going to be very bad for a lot of the council members who are bear hugging him for no reason.
I saw you reminding everyone that on his first day in office at the council, he got hugs from everyone else, every other council member. They took selfies. This was when you were stuck on the bus yesterday that you were able to tweet about this stuff. This is why the council should put in dedicated bus lanes to keep Scott off his phone.
I'm saying, yes. The faster my
talk about roasting vegetables.
The faster my bus trip goes, the less time that I have to just return to the fact that Mitch O'Farrell is not putting bus only lanes on Sunset. If it goes 6 miles an hour, man, my phone is out and it is burning hot. So, but yeah, I mean, if you want and actively seek out association politically with John Lee, then you will. As far as I'm concerned, you deserve what you're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is very, of course, bad and is tragic for the people who are like living on the streets in our city. It's like the latest in what has been an extremely negative summer, where we have city council members taking just more and more aggressive shots at the unhoused communities in terms of banning sleeping in cars, extending that ban, proposing to, as you mentioned earlier, Hayes, and other just places where homeless people might happen to be and exist during the course of the day, and now renewed attacks on actually building sites for homeless housing. It's shaping up to be a very, very bad year.
Let's talk about more homelessness-related stuff. Curbed, I saw reporting on this, Jenna Chandler, but it was in a few other places as well. The city council is, as they've been talking about, limiting the space that people who are homeless can occupy. One of the policy issues that they're looking at is trying to keep people from camping in hillside areas, not just to stop people from camping there, but actually send LAPD to encampments in these areas to remove people who are homeless. And a big reason for that is preventing wildfires up in those areas. I believe there was one last week, kind of a small brush fire that was knocked down pretty quickly. But this is not actually coming from the Housing and Homelessness Committee. This is coming from the Public Safety Committee. And of course, this is coming off of a couple years ago, the fires in kind of the North Brentwood area that I think burned down part of Rupert Murdoch's house were started at a homeless encampment off the 405.
The Pulvita Pass.
Yeah. As with every other limit on places that people who are homeless can occupy, they don't really have anywhere else to go except other places that they're not allowed to stay. So it is just moving people around. It's not getting people out of homelessness. But it is also, we've created circumstances where people are forced to move up into the hillside, into the woods, and it's incredibly dangerous. It is like if you have cooking fires out there and stuff, it can set off these really big fires. But what do you think? Should anyone be allowed to live up there then?
Well, yeah, that would be the reasoning, of course, that I would go directly towards. Is they're also trying to say that ADUs can't be built in these same very high risk zones.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like the fire map that you see where it's like basically, you know, everywhere in the hills is at risk of exploding in a major fire at any time. So they are trying to limit ADUs from being built unless you can have like a dedicated parking space or something like that, because all of this comes back to people being worried about getting out of their nice home because someone is going to try to be rescued or saved that might prevent them from driving with all their stuff down their street, their narrow street from their house.
So that's what would allow you to have residency up there, is a dedicated parking spot.
Right.
That's really the ADU
policy. I think
policy.
That's part of what the ADU, they're trying to stop unless you have, because they're redoing all these maps where they would, this is an ongoing thing, but they're redoing the maps where, you know, the red flag days where it says you cannot park on certain sides of the street just in case when it's windy or hot, just in case firefighters would need to get up there. So it's all about this idea of getting people out and getting, you know, having the roads clear, which is, you know, a panic situation where everybody tries to drive down when they should actually be trying to maybe walk or get out in a different way because it's not very efficient to all evacuate in our cars. But yeah, should anyone be living up there is the great question, because if we're going to say these people who have found probably a place to live, you know, a lot of it is along the freeways or freeway underpasses that we've seen. That was where the one along the 405 last year. And then there was also like a homeless encampment fire last week in the valley, like in the Sepulveda Basin. Same thing. Really scary situation. But yeah, if we're going to say that you can't live there without a home, I think we should be really reconsidering who should be able to be living there with homes as well if they're so worried about getting out.
I saw in Oakland, they're talking about in a very similar area.
Yeah,
they're talking about making it so people can't park
ever
on the street, on those windy streets up in the hilly areas where the nicer houses tend to be. But people who live up there are freaking out about that.
Same thing would
happen in the hills as well if you said, hey, we can't get a fire truck through here. This is the most fire sensitive area in the city.
Yeah.
So use your driveways.
Or don't have five cars.
Right.
And I think the Berkeley and Oakland Hills are very cognizant of this because they had a very devastating fire that killed a lot of people. And they even have taken advantage of their egress. Like they have taken the public stairways that go through all those neighborhoods, just like we have in a lot of our hilly neighborhoods. And they've cleared them in a way that people can actually walk to safety if they need to. I've seen nothing like that. No efforts like that to make sure like the stairways are clear or well marked, and because they probably don't want people using them to get to the Hollywood sign. So they would say, don't maintain these stairways. Really, we have to think about getting out of danger in a way that doesn't require putting all your belongings in a vehicle and pulling out behind your neighbor and driving down the hill. I mean, we can't think that way anymore. And if you're going to live there, you won't get out, you know?
I feel like the course of action that is being taken, particularly with respect to trying to restrict homeless people from going up and setting up encampments in these specific parts of town, much like all of the other restrictions that we've talked about, be they sleeping in cars, sleeping in parks, sleeping on benches, etc., all of those are missing what seem to be the core elements of the homelessness crisis that we're dealing with, which are, as you mentioned, Hayes, there are no places for people to go. There are not enough services for people to receive. There are not defined pathways for people to get the services that they need that can reasonably be accessed by the people who need them. at such time as they need them. Those are the main issues when we instead are focusing on where do homeless people happen to be. I get what you're saying about like being somewhat torn about this because the fire risk is a real one and it also poses a danger to homeless people themselves. Mm-hmm. But when we focus on that, I feel like eventually what it comes back to is that we are more focused on the quality of life for the people who are residing in homes, in houses, in these areas, as opposed to solving what I mentioned before as the core elements of the problem. How do we get those people within a proximity, both spatially and temporally, and in terms of access to the services that they need, mm-hmm. so that these other sorts of issues that fan out from those can actually be resolved? This all just seems to me pointed in the same direction, which is we want to be able to maintain a status quo, which is self-evidently failing all over this city for the people, the small subset of the population for whom it seems like it is working relatively well. It doesn't seem like we are ever going to get to a place where we say to people who live in the hills, like, you're not allowed to live here anymore. I can't even imagine what that would look like, but it does seem like it doesn't make sense for us to bend over backwards to protect them, even to the detriment of other Angelenos who are living unsheltered.
Related to that, we are going to talk a little bit to kind of close off our conversation about housing for people who are homeless. A report came out this week from the comptroller's office. We don't have a comptroller in LA. It's just
a difference. I've always
there is absolutely no difference. And I think you actually may be supposed to pronounce comptroller controller as well in cities that have it. It's very stupid. Controller Ron Galperin put out a report on LHASA, the LA Homeless Services Authority. They've been contracting with the city. The city only provides like a really small fraction of LHASA's funding, but they've been contracting for these outreach programs with the city. And Ron Galperin put out this report that was pretty grim. Basically, LHASA made contact with 6,600 people in the city using the outreach funds that they got from the city. Out of that, only 56 people got into mental health services, 39 got into substance abuse services, and 167 got into permanent housing.
Wow.
That's a very small number.
Yep.
Through CELA, when we do outreach, we do a lot of putting people into the LHASA system through their LA HOP program. And then we get an email saying, hey, we made contact with this person thanks to your report. Like, great. But we get no follow-up from that. They're not allowed to say what happened as a result mm-hmm. of it. And so it's very depressing to basically know that almost none of those people that we were trying to connect to these exact services got any help.
Right.
That said, I think it's a pretty complicated issue, like how to allocate blame between LHASA and the city. Certainly when it comes to getting people into permanent housing, LHASA can't build that housing.
Yeah.
But we want to talk about it more late. We've invited Ron Galperin to come on the show and talk about it. It seems like it might happen. So maybe we'll save a little of that conversation for later and instead talk about scooters.
Yeah.
Back to scooters. Curbed again had a banger on this issue this week. Elijah Chiland wrote an article, headline, "Are scooters too dangerous for LA streets?" A headline doesn't necessarily reflect the content of the article, but basically he got Paul Koretz, council member in the 5th District, who announced the elite squad for scooters last week from the LAPD. He got Paul Koretz on record talking about scooters. And what did he say, Alyssa?
These quotes were just, they look like they were like written by an algorithm from like the conversations that we've had before on like these shows,
but like an even more like distemperate algorithm, like a more hostile algorithm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying out loud that you basically think that people who ride scooters should die.
He did not say that
they should die. He said that he would prefer that they die. He said that he would prefer that they die to pedestrians, basically. He said, I'd rather have the rider put at risk because they're the ones taking the scooters voluntarily rather than the innocent pedestrians that are not volunteering to take a scooter, knowing how unsafe they may be. This is actually similar to a New York Post article that came out today, Sunday, that I saw people talking about, that was saying bicyclists are killing pedestrians and nobody is talking about it. I think it was 7 pedestrians were killed by bicyclists since 2014 or something like that. I forget exactly. Compared to well in the thousands of...
You could find that in a single incident with a car.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
You definitely could.
Yes. Of people who were killed by cars. But it was also interesting to see him talking about how he basically doesn't think there's a political will to getting lanes put in place. He said like something like you'd have to he said, we already built everything for cars. It's very hard for us to reverse. If you tried to put in a bike lane on Beverly Boulevard, for instance, there just isn't the width for it. And if you had to put in a road diet to make room for the bike lanes, you would back up traffic so badly that people would want to have our heads on a rail. So saying outright, and he's deprioritizing safety for people who ride scooters, and that he just doesn't have the political flex.
Yeah, just admitting that I'm not doing this because I am worried that people who have a lot of money will yell at me or something like that.
Yes, that people would be mad at me.
We've already built everything for cars is an interesting construction, especially coming from noted environmentalist Paul Koretz.
Yeah.
It's kind of like saying the planet is going to end, but like, you know, this infrastructure
is for us to reverse it.
This infrastructure is already here. So we might as well just, you know, live with it, I guess, until the end.
I mean, but it shows kind of what these people respond to, which is the threat of people being angry at them. That anger is growing from people that want to pursue other modes of transportation. It happened this week. Also, Curb talked about this, the Sunset for All campaign.
Yep.
I saw you talking about it, Scott, to put dedicated bike lanes from downtown to East Hollywood, and lots of people going after Mitch O'Farrell for that. I mean, it's unfortunate that this is the way it has to work, but do you just have to be angrier and greater in number than the people that are angry about cars going slow?
I think you absolutely do. I'm not the Sunset for All people, as far as I'm aware, have a pretty good working relationship with O'Farrell's office, and I don't want to tarnish that by being associated with them, which I'm not.
Some people in the article, I believe, were critical of O'Farrell, or maybe it was just you.
But yeah, no, I do believe that that is kind of the way forward, because you have a status quo where the majority of the people who a given council district hears from, or at least so they say, are vocally opposed to anything that would slow down car travel times, whether that is actually the case or whether or not they just happen to be paying more attention to those voices as opposed to people who ride transit or biking. I can't say for sure, but I do think that there is a clear series of evidence in the behavior that I've seen from council districts that suggests that they see the people who advocate for bike infrastructure, now scooter infrastructure, even pedestrian infrastructure. We have Paul Koretz saying that he wants the city to be safer for pedestrians. That's not borne out in the way that our sidewalks look, and that's why the city got slapped with a more than, how much was that? It was over $1 billion settlement, because pedestrian access has also suffered under the unchecked reign of the car infrastructure that Paul Koretz is talking about. So if you have a constituency that city council does not feel like they can ignore, I think at that point, then you'll start to see things change. But until then, this is the way that they're responding for a reason. And that reason is exactly what Chris said.
On the climate thing, which again, this week is going to be a huge week for discussing these issues on a national stage. We have the CNN Climate Crisis Town Hall on Tuesday of this week, or on Wednesday of this week, Wednesday on the 4th. And so it's going to be 7 hours of them interviewing the candidates about their, you know, what they think they should do about climate change, and then having the questions from the audience. And I wrote a story last week just looking at Bernie Sanders' Green New Deal plan, which it relies, again, heavily on getting everybody an electric car. Like, this is the magic thing that's going to save everything. And I know for sure that this is also something that people like Paul Koretz, like, think that this can be a solution. Like, we just can keep driving. We can drive our way out of this. And we absolutely cannot. And even in our own Green New Deal for the city of LA, it says we have to reduce our trips and we have to shift some of our trips to walking and biking currently now. I mean, this is not even like a 10-year away thing. So you have to very explicitly say the room needs to be made on the streets immediately. I mean, we don't have any more time at this point. And I don't know how to get to people who are just literally think they're going to, you know, snap their fingers and everyone gets an electric car and keeps driving the same way that they were doing before, because it's not how it's going to work.
I mean, I honestly, at a certain point, think that the current politicians in city council are maybe beyond like the ability to come around on things like the Green New Deal, like the reallocation of space on city roads to transit and bikes. Koretz is going to be termed out in a couple of years, but he has had a reputation since the 80s as being a politician who is not going to stick his neck out politically for something that could cause him backlash, which is to say, he's not a leader. He is somebody who does a very good job at following politics of his constituents. In this case, his constituents are Council District 5, a very wealthy, by LA city standards, exceptionally white district, and elderly.
Even then, it is some percentage of those constituents, which I would say is probably not the majority, but at least the ones that are loudest about stuff.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's like where the power base there is and has been. And that's who he follows. And he's saying directly in this article, I'm not going to do anything that could cause me political backlash. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, the right thing to do or whatever. I think that the politician who's willing to do that is a rare breed, especially if it's not one of their key issues that they really care about.
Let's get into it with Maya. Wow. Any introduction for this? There's so many things that you could introduce about the sheriff's department, but does it happen in the interview?
Yes, it does.
Okay, great. Enjoy, and I will listen too.
Today, we have a very exciting returning guest, Maya Lau of the LA Times. Maya covers the sheriff's department beat, which is, I mean, this is maybe not a good thing, but it is one of the most interesting beats in LA. You probably would not wish that about
it. Just got way more interesting.
There's so much that we can't even begin to discuss, everything that Maya's been working on. But of course, she is one of our favorite people to name check on this podcast. So we're really excited to have you back, Maya. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, again. Thanks for having me.
This has been, as Alyssa was alluding to, an extremely busy summer, I guess, for the sheriff's department.
Yeah, the whole year.
It's just been wild. How do you keep up with everything that is happening?
That was going to be my question.
Alyssa can ask it.
You know, I had to do a couple paragraphs just to summarize everything that's happened with the sheriff's department in a story recently. And I actually had to search my own articles and read and remind myself because I just can't remember all of the things that have happened. It's a lot. Yeah, I just, you know, keep up with my sources and, you know, I really have so many tips, more tips than I could ever follow. So just trying to keep organized. But yeah, it's a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on.
Honestly, when you think about the things that you had asked me, like, what do we want to talk about? And I went just kind of what was top of mind for me. And then I was thinking about the things that we're not going to talk about today. It's pretty astonishing that FBI is investigating sheriff's deputy Clicks. That's a topic you've covered a lot and we've spoken to you about in the past. The sheriff, Alex Villanueva, hired his son, who has made questionable jokes or posted questionable memes on social media. There was a fake sniper incident in the Antelope Valley. And those are the things that we don't have time to talk about. That's really wild. One of the things that we want to talk to you about, because we've been talking a lot about a specific deputy who was reinstated by Alex Villanueva, Carl Mondayon. His reinstatement was just very recently invalidated by a California judge. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and what the most recent news is with Mondayon?
Yeah, so it's Mondayon.
Oh my God, Mondayon.
Yeah, which I think is easier to pronounce.
It is.
So I had reported that Mondayon, who had been a campaign volunteer for Villanueva, was rehired after being fired by the previous sheriff. He was rehired by Villanueva, and then that caused the Board of Supervisors to, you know, get really angry and sue the sheriff and sue the sheriff's department, which is really rare for, you know, the county to in some ways to kind of be suing itself or to be suing a department within over the reinstatement, because his firing had already been upheld by the Civil Service Commission. So it had been this very formal process. And finally, a judge weighed in and granted an injunction against the reinstatement that the county had asked for and said, no, you're not a deputy anymore. You have to turn in your badge and gun effective basically immediately. And this was a couple weeks ago. And so kind of what that did was underscore that the County Board of Supervisors does have some power over the sheriff's employees. You know, they're the ultimate employer. So they can say, as they had been trying to say before, like, we're the employer, you don't work for us. Mondayon and his lawyer and the sheriff had been, you know, defiant and said, no, I'm still going to keep working, even though the county had stopped paying him.
Right. So where is Mondayon now?
So he's supposed to not be working for the sheriff's department.
And has it been confirmed that he is not at this point? Or?
He's not, according to, you know, officially. I mean, I don't know if he's still off volunteering somewhere, but no, I mean, he's not supposed to be working for the sheriff's department.
Right. And how did Alex Villanueva
take the judge's ruling.
Well, he did something that he does a lot, which is attack the Board of Supervisors. He said that, you know, this was just another example of the Board of Supervisors kind of having some sway and trying to flex their muscle. So he, you know, I think he still feels he referenced that there's still going to be more evidence to come out in that case. That lawsuit is not actually over, just because the way that it works is first there's a preliminary injunction and then there's actually a trial that's scheduled. So that after a trial, that would be the point when, you know, a judge would weigh in. It's going to be a bench trial. But, you know, Villanueva referenced that there's more evidence to come out that would exonerate Mandoyan. Meanwhile, that's not really what the case is about. The case is not about relitigating Mandoyan's disciplinary case. So it's unclear whether the judge will even let that evidence come in. But that's kind of how he reacted, just, you know, to say, you know, I still stand by my decision.
What is it about more specifically then? It's specifically about the authority of the board to terminate his employment.
It's about whether or not Sheriff Villanueva had the authority to reinstate somebody who was fired and whose firing was upheld by the Civil Service Commission. That's what the case is actually about.
The way that this goes forward from here, we know Villanueva has established a truth and reconciliation panel, that is his term for it, where he said that there was a lot of political influence, a lot of basically outside interference that had led to deputies being let go or punished for misconduct in ways that he felt like was unfair. Does this ruling change for Villanueva, for the sheriff's department, how they proceed with that, or does that still remain to be seen at this point?
Well, Villanueva has paused the so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission that he started. Mandoyan's case was the only case to go through that. And even then, it wasn't a fully fledged panel. Mm-hmm. The board asked him to stop, and he did. And so technically, there is no Truth and Reconciliation Commission in operation. But I think that, you know, Villanueva has still kind of referenced that there are these hundreds of deputies that were unjustly fired in the past, and that's still a passion for him, a passion project. So it's conceivable that that would be revisited in some way.
Right. I know you mentioned this is very rare, but for two very powerful elected bodies, in this case, the sheriff himself and then the county, is there any precedent in LA for this kind of high level conflict about who has the authority to do what?
Yeah, the Board of Supervisors, they kept saying that they felt that this was unprecedented. I mean, I haven't gone through every you know, decision that's ever been made in the county, but it does seem very unusual. I mean, these are two bodies that have to work together. The board actually funds the sheriff's department. They allocate its funding. So there's a lot of back and forth. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize the sheriff doesn't report to the board. They're not his boss.
So who does he report to? Because I think that's what a lot of people are wondering.
Nobody except the voters.
And is that like a county scenario? Is that because we have this governing body that's gigantic?
I think it has to do with the California Constitution and the fact that he's elected. So the only way to get rid of him is through a recall election. That's also a very formal process, or to vote him out.
Right.
In comparison, that our city police force, they report to the mayor.
Right. The police chief is appointed by the mayor and reports to the mayor, and the police commission can weigh in as well. But
this is why we need an LA County king, clearly.
Well, I mean, as Maya's saying, like the state constitution says very specifically, like, charter counties need to have specific charter employees who are going to be elected by the voters. I think there are different ways that you can go about doing that, but the basic structure, unlike with city governments, is laid out very clearly by the state. And so you end up with I would imagine, fairly uncommon scenario where you do have these two bodies that are just not accountable to anybody except for the voters, being completely at odds with apparently their vision for what the administration of law enforcement looks like here. It's interesting to watch it play out.
Right. I mean, and this is, I think, a time when the question of who has the authority is really being tested, because in the past, it probably wasn't tested. It probably was more like, oh, we work together and we use soft power and we kind of, you know, have our different issues that we win or lose on, but we're not going to sue each other. And this time it was, you know, a judge had to weigh in on, wait a second, you know.
As sheriff, Alex Villanueva has cast, as you were saying earlier, the board as being a politically minded group, and he kind of has cast himself as being distinct from that. You've been following him more closely than anybody else. Does he seem like he is shying away from politics to you, in his role as sheriff? That's kind of how, in my view, I see him as presenting himself as being not somebody who is beholden to political interests. Curious if, as somebody who has followed him very carefully, if that's also your read.
I mean, he's a politician at the end of the day. He got elected. He had to campaign. A lot of politicians say, like, oh, I'm not a politician, but, you know, you still are. And he's very sore about, some people have called him the sore winner. You know, he's sore about the fact that nobody on the board endorsed him. Mm-hmm. You know, it is true that the political establishment largely did not endorse him, very skeptical of his candidacy. And so he feels that they, for that reason, are still out to get him and that they just cannot accept that he won. And so I think that that's kind of where he tries to say, like, they're politicians, like, I'm different. Right. You know, I didn't come from that establishment. I wasn't accepted by that establishment. But yeah, I don't know if he's, what his trajectory is, if he's looking to you know, continue to reach other offices or what his goal is in terms of that.
Right. One of the administrators who was very critical of the Mendoyan rehiring was County Inspector General Max Huntsman, whose office looked through the facts of the case of his firing, of his punishment by the Civil Service Commission or board. Is it
the Civil Service Commission?
Civil Service Commission, and found that was, in their view, a justifiable firing. Huntsman, Inspector General Huntsman, has also been critical about what his office sees as the secrecy of the Sheriff's Department with respect to personnel issues in general. So immediately after he issued a report on the findings of the Inspector General's office, with respect to how Villanueva's sheriff's department has been conducting itself early in his tenure as sheriff, there was a story that came out in the LA Times by you that the inspector general's office itself was under investigation by the sheriff's department. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening there? I think that was a story that kind of showed up and then went away, but
there were so many other stories that followed were even more shocking. Yeah,
but it was a very surprising bit of news, I think, that came out. So what's happening there?
Yeah, so the Sheriff's Department is criminally investigating the Office of Inspector General, which is the Sheriff's Department's watchdog. So that's also very unusual.
Right.
You know, Max Huntsman, the inspector general, says that this appears to have started, like you said, not long after he puts out a big report that really questions and analyzes the decision to bring Mendoyan back. And Huntsman's conclusion is that he shouldn't have been brought back. The review process was very sketchy. And he says that Villanueva had personally kind of warned him against, like, if you release the Mendoyan report, you know, like, there will be consequences or something like that. And so he feels like this is some kind of retaliation and intimidation campaign. And, you know, it is really, again, unusual for the inspector general's job is to monitor the sheriff's department. And so the accusation from the sheriff's department is that the inspector general has obtained files that they're not supposed to obtain, that, you know, they've broken the law in some way by obtaining confidential internal files. And of course, the inspector general says, well, that's actually our job. It's it's in the charter. It's part of the whole agreement for how we're even able to do our job. And so I think that a lot of people are looking at this as intimidation.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see kind of what happens with that. And if, you know, people have said it's not ethical, it's, you know, if they wanted truly for the IG to be investigated, you know, could they have called in some outside entity to do it? Because if they do it, if the sheriff's department does it, there's a conflict.
Yeah. And among the people who have called into questions the ethics of this are some of the board of supervisors, again, again, butting heads with the sheriff on this issue. I think Alyssa's question about accountability comes back again here. in the event that, that there is always the possibility that these claims about the Inspector General's office are true, in that case, who is the Inspector General accountable to? Who is the one who is directing his work and his office's work?
The county.
Right.
I mean, he, I guess, reports to the county that that's who created his office. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. The sheriff's department was part of what they were trying to do is to ask the county to make Max Huntsman step aside while this investigation was going on and recuse himself. The county decided not to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's all just like very,
right,
you know, circular. These different bodies are kind of like all butting heads.
Right. And so this is kind of an area where the overseer of the sheriff's department, the auditor of the sheriff's department, is caught in this crossfire, right, between. Yeah. Okay. Right.
I wanted to go back to the intimidation techniques, because we see a person who goes on Twitter, goes after journalists in your case, like trying to tell on you. You know, we've talked about this on the show several times. Again, it's kind of like someone else like I can think of that retaliates on Twitter sometimes. But what, again, is the precedent for this type of thing? Like using like the notes app on your phone to like write statements that aren't going through the press, you know, representative for the county or something like that. I mean, this is, it just seems like sometimes he's just in his house, like typing out things on his phone and like send tweet. And it's a little troubling. There's, again, no oversight maybe, or nobody he has to run his statements by.
Yeah. I don't know on that front, on the media front, certainly the press office has changed a lot. I can't speak to, you know, what the decision-making is, but the thing that some people have brought up, including Max Huntsman, is of course, back in the Lee Baca era, the whole thing that brought him down, former Sheriff Lee Baca, is a campaign or a movement to try to intimidate an FBI agent who is investigating the sheriff's department. So I think that this has reminded some people of, well, gee, this is exactly the kind of behavior that got the sheriff's department in trouble, in big trouble a long time, or not even that long ago. And
yeah, only and what, so, six
yeah,
years ago?
Yeah, and so, yeah, right. And so there's this question of like, can they police themselves? And then when they are being policed, you know, how do they react?
Respond? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is even more ironic that that is something that Max Huntsman, as Inspector General, had just been reporting on it.
Right. And he, part of why his office was created and why the Civilian Oversight Commission was created was out of the Baca era and out of like this, okay, clearly the Sheriff's Department needs more oversight so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Speaking of which, in terms of the way that we oversee, as one public in LA County, that we oversee police conduct, one of the major talking points for Alex Villanueva when he was on the campaign trail was his opposition to making available names on what is known as the Brady List. There was some news that came out this week in terms of the California Supreme Court handed down a ruling saying that it was okay for defense lawyers to have access to names of police officers who were on the Brady List and to use those as evidence in trying to say that police conduct had maybe not been above board in specific cases. Can you tell us a bit about what the Brady List is and why it is contentious or viewed as controversial by the sheriff?
Yeah, so the Brady List is, a lot of police departments have these lists of officers who have been found, usually through internal investigations, to have lied, stolen, you know, any number of, even domestic violence, any number of acts that can be considered what is called moral turpitude, which are things that could call into question their credibility if they're able to testify, if they testify. And of course, officers testify in court all the time. That's one of their main functions. So the Sheriff's Department had a Brady List. There were about 300 names on it. It had come to light that there was this list, and the department was notifying deputies, look, you're on this list. You have an opportunity to appeal it, but this is why you're on it. And these information might be handed over actually to prosecutors. That was what the proposal was, not that it would be handed straight to defendants, but that it'd be handed to prosecutors. And there's a huge lawsuit about it that, like you said, just resolved this week. It's a big deal because it has been just a highly anticipated California Supreme Court decision that ultimately sided with the sheriff's department. The thing, though, is the sheriff who kind of initiated all this action was former Sheriff Jim McDonnell.
Right.
Now we know that Sheriff Villanueva has a very different attitude toward the Brady List. And as you said, he has questioned it. He thinks a lot of it is flawed, that people who are on it shouldn't be on it, that other people who aren't on it should be on it. Like, he's kind of really attacked it. But basically what this court ruling says is, if there's a Brady list in a police department, then that police department can hand over the names and employee ID numbers of those people who are on it to prosecutors. And from there, prosecutors can then further investigate. They could theoretically hand those names over to defense attorneys. Those attorneys can file what are called pitches motions in court to actually discover more of the details behind what the officers did. And really the whole reason that this is even an issue is because we live in California, which has some of the strictest protections on officer personnel files in the country. If you go to other states, they don't even have this problem. They don't even understand like what we're talking about here, because they can hand over Brady information freely.
This would be considered in the public's interest to know.
Well, it's actually a constitutional right of the defendant to be able to obtain favorable information. The prosecution, you know, under this landmark Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland, it said that the prosecution, because they have the burden of proof, they have an obligation to hand over favorable evidence to the defense. They can't just hold stuff back because they, I guess they have more power and they have more ability to even have that evidence. Yeah. So basically in California, though, officer personnel files are so protected that it's actually been illegal for even prosecutors to directly access internal files of officer misconduct.
Wow.
Now, a little bit of that has changed with SB 1421, which opened up some officer personnel misconduct files, namely just dishonesty, sexual misconduct, and then some shootings and serious uses of force. But that doesn't cover, say, domestic violence necessarily, or you know, other kinds of misconduct that could impair a police witness's credibility. So anyway, this long way of saying what this ruling does is it says if a department has a Brady list, yes, they can indeed hand those names over to prosecutors, and that does not violate California law.
So Maura Dolan, who reported this story for The Times, noted that the way that the Supreme Court ruling was handed down was pretty narrow in scope. That being said, it could still be pretty impactful in terms of the way that local misconduct by police is brought to bear in court cases. Does that sound?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that what the ruling did also was just clarify things that we already knew, which is that the prosecution team, which is defined as prosecutors and the police, have an affirmative duty to hand over favorable evidence to the defense. It just kind of clarified some of that, because a lower appeals court in California had actually, and I should say this whole lawsuit was brought by the deputies union. It's the deputies union that did not want the Brady list to be disclosed in any way to prosecutors. A lower appeals court had sided with the deputies union and made it explicitly barred handing over these names. And so now the Supreme Court is reversing that and saying, yes, it's okay to hand over the names. And also just in general, by the way, as a reminder to all, police and prosecutors do have this duty to comply with Brady and hand over this information. So it does, you know, it does kind of clarify things. It's not like a sweeping, it doesn't, you know, open up the floodgates or anything, but it, I think, is being seen as like a step toward transparency.
And as you mentioned, as I mentioned, the current sheriff may not necessarily, I would say definitely doesn't have the same view of the Brady list and disclosures of names on the Brady list as did his predecessor. That was one of his main points of appeal to the sheriff's deputies union. How has the sheriff publicly responded to this ruling?
He has said that he will comply with it. He will, of course, comply if prosecutors ask his office for that kind of information on deputies. He also said something in his statement about how he will not be maintaining a Brady list. I'm not sure exactly what that means, if that means that he no longer has a Brady list or will just not be updating the list that was already there.
It's like the Google Doc is, you know, will not be updating.
Going into disuse. Yeah,
right. So, and I've asked for clarification on that, so we'll see. But yeah, that, you know, that's the statement that they put out, and we'll kind of see how that ends up playing out.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that sounds like potentially he might still be trying. He'll comply with the ruling as written, but attempt not to give more information than
it could be that he would wait to be asked for information mm-hmm. versus what McDonald was trying to do was proactively hand over information.
Right. Maya, thank you so much for returning and talking to us about the Sheriff's Department. Of course, it's one of our favorite topics here. We love having you on. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. Fog is gonna have the news.
Thanks, Maya. Wow, that was so good. No, I haven't really listened to it yet. next week, I think we're going to have a pretty exciting guest. Are we safe to announce it now, or can they just come back and maybe not? Okay. Well, now you know it's really exciting since we can't even announce it yet. But listen to us then on LA Podcast. Bye-bye. LA Podcast. LA Podcast. LA Podcast is going to have